Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation.
This is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly look at the issues that matter to the residents of the San Joaquin Valley.
Hello, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition. On this election day, we talk propositions, campaign funding, and what is expected to be a very, very close presidential election. Joining us for the discussion, Fresno Bee columnist Bill McEwen and Fresno State political science professor Tom Holyoke. Also, the local response to Superstorm Sandy, plus a preview of the Dance Theater of Harlem. But first, when the results for Proposition 30 come in this evening, California voters won't just have returned a verdict on whether they support raising taxes to reduce the state's budget deficit. They will also have handed Governor Jerry Brown a victory or defeat on his signature policy issue. As Ben Atler reports from Sacramento, the outcome and Brown's reaction to it could shape the rest of his time in the governor's office.
Let's start with a flashback to the year 1978.
Summer lovin' had me a blast.
Summer lovin' happened so fast.
The movie Grease came out, and a much younger California Governor Jerry Brown faced a striking rebuke when voters approved Proposition 13 in a landslide. Days later, the governor who campaigned so strongly against Prop 13 vowed to heed the message Californians sent to Sacramento.
The message is that the property tax must be sharply curtailed and that government spending, wherever it is, must be held in check. We must look forward to lean and frugal budgets. It's a great challenge, and we will meet it.
And he did, implementing Prop 13 so thoroughly that the measure's author, Howard Jarvis, endorsed the governor for re-election later that year. Now, 3.5 decades later, Brown could soon find himself at a similar crossroads. The governor is once again on the campaign trail over a statewide ballot measure.
I want to pull my sign up in case anybody is watching. It's Proposition 30. Please vote yes. Thank you.
But many analysts give the measure at best a 50-50 chance of passing. And just as taxpayers, schools, and nearly every interest group in the state have much at stake with Prop 30, so too does Jerry Brown, who, after all, has spent his entire return to the governor's office building to this point. Republican political consultant Rob Stutzman.
If it passes, it's a tremendous victory for the governor. He acquires a lot of political capital, especially with a legislature that has about 40 new members coming into the assembly.
And Brown could use that capital to advance the rest of his agenda without quite so big a budget cloud hanging over Sacramento. Here's his political advisor, Steve Glazer.
There's so many other things that he would like to put his time and attention to.
Like working on a new water system, for instance.
But the foundation of it all is to have a balanced budget and fiscal stability.
On the other hand, says Stutzman,
if the governor doesn't win with Prop 30, his political capital probably rapidly declines.
Perhaps even leading to the two words every politician hates to hear.
He could almost move into a bit of an early lame duck status because he will have not been able to persuade the public to stay with him on what he says the solution is.
And not just voters. Last year, Brown tried to reach a budget deal with Republicans, but those talks fell through, with each side blaming the other. This year, it was Democrats who wouldn't agree to some of the governor's proposed pension changes. And Democratic consultant Steve Maviglio says Brown's job wouldn't get any easier with Prop 30's failure.
As far as his momentum, if he loses, I think he's in a very difficult place because he's only going to have to make more unpopular decisions.
Like whether to hold firm on $6 billion in automatic budget cuts or look for different cuts or new revenues instead. Plus, it's likely he'd have to make even deeper cuts next year. Still, Republican strategist Marty Wilson says don't underestimate what an experienced governor can do.
I've worked for two governors. That's a very powerful office. I mean, he'll have plenty of heft, and he knows how to use it.
Which is why we started this story with a look back at 1978 and the aftermath of Prop 13. The big question this year, if Prop 30 fails, is whether Brown would embrace the will of the voters or look for a way around them. In a recent interview with Capital Public Radio, the governor made his position clear.
I will veto any bill that attempts to undo the trigger cuts. We have to balance our budget.
Thanks largely to Brown's track record 34 years ago, the consultants we spoke with for this story appear to believe him. But if Prop 30 fails, the governor would face pressure from school groups, teachers' unions, and lawmakers in both parties to find alternatives to eliminating 3 weeks of classes. At the state capitol, I'm Ben Adler.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. Joining me now to finish our discussion is a professor, political science professor, Tom Holyoke from Fresno State. You know, when you look at Proposition 30, fail or pass, it's going to have an impact. Many say it'll have an impact on Governor Brown's ability to govern. Many say his political power, you know, could rise or fall depending on the outcome of this tax initiative. Is that sort of what happens when you have such a hands-on role in an initiative, or do you think it will have an impact either way, Professor Holyoke?
Well, happy Election Day. yes, Governor Brown has pretty clearly staked a great deal of his credibility and political capital on Proposition 30. So if that fails, that would be a significant setback for him in terms of his ability to deal with the legislature and his ability to really get some other things done in the near term. Now, Governor Brown has shown in the past that he is able to pull himself back together after suffering defeats. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't count him down for the rest of his term.
So you don't think it'll have a long-term impact in any way with the way the legislature functions or not functions anyway? At some point, if he is a strong leader, he could come back.
Yes, I think he has shown the kind of political skills that, you know, allows him to, you know, rebuild his political power after a time, certainly.
Well, let's take a look at these two education propositions first off, because you have Proposition 30, which people are saying if it doesn't pass, I think it is, what is it, $6 billion in trigger cuts automatically go into effect?
That's correct.
And then the other one, Proposition 38, and you had both of these education measures on the ballot, and didn't doing that in itself hurt each one of the propositions?
Yes, it does so in a number of different ways. Yes, we have two competing measures to try to raise additional tax revenue for schools. And when you have two measures out there, first off, some people are going to be inclined to vote one over the other. So you take a base set of supporters in California and you start dividing them. I mean, some they could easily vote for both propositions, but there's going to be some people who will support 38 rather than 30 and vice versa. Also, that just tends to confuse voters. And when voters start getting confused, they tend to vote no or they don't vote on the propositions at all.
And also, the latest polls show that the support for both of them have really kind of fallen off.
Yeah, Proposition 38, certainly. Now, Proposition 30, it's a little trickier. Yes, it's the last Public Policy Institute of California field poll put it at 48%, but it also found that 14% of the electorate hadn't made up their minds. So Governor Brown only needs to capture a fairly small portion of those undecideds to put Prop 30 over the top.
And Prop 30, it really is still very much in play. But you, yes, as you mentioned, support for Proposition 38 dropped off fairly quickly. Do you think once people got a look at it and it was confusing, they just said, never mind, I'll just look at the other one? Or,
well, I think a lot of that is because the governor and his political allies, particularly many of the teachers' unions and the university systems, have really been pushing for Prop 30, not Prop 38. So many of the political powers that be in California have thrown their weight behind Prop 30, and that's made a difference.
Let's look at just Prop 30 in itself, because when you look at the measure and you look at what we're facing when it comes to education, there appears to be a lot riding on that. That said, and you take a look at the cutbacks we have already faced when it comes to education, not just in K-12, but all you have to do is take a look at our California, the CSU system, the community college, to see how much they have already been impacted. So what could this mean for these institutions?
Well, Juanita, as as a Fresno State professor, and let's be clear, I try to be unbiased about this, but I get a little worked up about these things. The CSU has been getting cut for years now, and we've been cut down to the bone. And if Prop 30 fails, they're going to start hacking off limbs. The university will almost certainly constrict in the number of classes that can be offered, and probably the number of majors that can be offered. And we'll certainly constrict in the number of students that we're going to be able to admit simply because we can't serve anymore. So, yeah, the results, I think, would be devastating to the education system of this country. And because education is tightly linked to economic performance, that kind of harm to education leads to pretty serious harm, I believe, for California's economy.
Do you think part of what we're seeing when it comes to these propositions is maybe just a sort of weary electorate? It's not that they don't think maybe education does need more funding, but they've been through all these past budget battles from the state capitol, and they've heard this so much before, so it's hard to get them to really look at the issue for what it is.
Yeah, there's certainly a lot of that. What's happening, I think, is that there is a lot of cynicism in the public about the way California government works and the way the state spends its money, and deservedly so. And so when the people who are opposed to Prop 30 make the argument that this is just more money for the California state government to waste, it's pretty easy to believe that. So it's hard to convince voters to open up their wallets, pay a little bit more when the California doesn't have a great history of money management.
Yeah, it makes it difficult for a lot of folks. Well, one of the big developments before we get to some of the other proposition really has been the charges about all of the out-of-state groups pouring money into California in these campaigns. And we saw a lot of it with Proposition 30, 32, and some of the others. And, charges have been filed and there is an investigation going on. I mean, we've seen this. You notice the ads. You notice the difference. And the fact is this going to be the norm now? Because it's
Assuming that the United States Supreme Court doesn't reverse its rulings in like Citizens United, Wisconsin Right to Life, and Speech Now, those big cases the last few years, or if Congress doesn't pass significant new legislation, then yes, I think we are seeing the new norm, because right now it is very easy to move large amounts of money and to do so quickly and secretly.
Right. When you say secretly, what happens, though, let's say this current investigation they have going on, if the outcome they can prove has been charged money laundering by one of these groups, will that have any kind of an impact?
Well, it's not going to have an impact on this election because at this point there is no way that information is going to be able to come out. In fact, particular investigation is showing just how convoluted our money system has become. So the organization that funneled the $11 million into California, it revealed who its contributors were. Its contributors were other organizations, which doesn't really tell you anything. So you have shadow organizations contributing to other shadow organizations and to a large extent are being protected by parts of the tax code, the 501c4 designation of the tax code, where you can contribute to a social welfare organization and that organization doesn't have to reveal its contributors, at least not right now, and it's free to send its money on to other organizations and largely spend it on what it wants.
Well, and some people will argue and say because of this, if you have enough money and you're willing just to pour it into one issue, you can literally just kind of buy that particular campaign.
This election, I mean, California, nationally, we're probably talking around $3 or $4 billion.
And a lot of people will say, just think what we could do with all that money.
Well, yeah. You could basically plug the hole in California's education system almost.
It's tough. We've seen a lot of money fly around. Now, there are also a number of other propositions that are important to the Valley. Because of our ag-based economy, Proposition 37, the genetically engineered foods.
Yeah.
And The fight over that, because some are saying there's a lot of that that's already happening anyway, as far as the labeling.
Yeah, I mean, the U.S. Department of Agriculture already requires a fair amount of labeling on foods and everything. And, you know, genetically modified foods, this one comes out of a concern a lot of people have about what does it mean to have genetically modified food? You know, in what ways have you changed the makeup and the structure of, you know, the plants? And, you know, does this create then a health hazard? And there's been a lot of research on this. I don't think it's been proven conclusively at all that genetically modified food is dangerous. But, you know, there's an argument.
But, you know, but part of what it is, I think, coming from people, and you're right, it hasn't been proven whether it's good for you or bad for you. Yeah. But people are saying, you know, I just have the right to know what's in my food.
Yeah, so this is, this really comes down to an issue of consumer choice. You know, if consumers really want to make the make a decision on what they buy based on the structure of the food, then, well, we'll find out what Californians want today.
And we have, there are two issues impacting, you know, criminal law. Of course, another effort to revise the three strikes law and totally repeal the death penalty and replace it with life in prison.
Yeah, these are actually fairly significant changes, I believe, to a lot of California's criminal law, especially with three strikes. I mean, I guess the concern has been on the third strike, you know, the third crime committed, that you know, just about anything you do would you know, qualify you to for imprisonment. And since California already has a very serious problem with overcrowded prisons and the huge amount of money it spends on prisons, then there's probably an argument to be made that maybe three strikes ought to be modified a little bit.
And the death penalty, the death penalty was interesting in that when it came to people who were supporting it, it way more money was poured into changing it so that it would be life in prison than those who wanted to keep it as is, because so many people felt that the whole system is kind of broken anyway. People stay on death row for forever.
The death penalty one, it's a little counterintuitive, I think, in that it costs more to put a person to death than it does to, you know, keep them, support them, and give them health care in prison for the rest of their lives. But that seems to be the way the numbers shake out from the research on this, basically because it was before a person can actually be executed, they have a large number of appeals. Much of that is publicly funded, and in the end, the way the numbers add up, and so I'm told, it costs more to put a person to death than simply imprison them.
That's what they said. And they also said many of the from the research that I've read, that many of the inmates on death row didn't want this to pass either because it limited their opportunities for appeal. Under the current system, you know, they get all the support, they get all the resources they need, they get representation to appeal the whole process. And with this new law, it would shorten the appeal process.
Yes, I've been told the same thing. I've talked to some of my colleagues over in our, you know, Department of Criminology at the university, and that's basically what they say.
Okay. Another change that we do have in this election that I'd like to discuss a little is that, you know, when we changed part of the election process so that the two top vote getters would end up facing off, and we have that situation now in the 23rd Assembly District, we have two Republicans in Bob Whalen and Jim Patterson who are facing off against each other.
This has actually been one of the more interesting parts of this election here in California, the possibility that you can have, you know, very intense general elections of people in the same party. And yes, the Whalen-Patterson race locally, because of this, that's turned out to be one of the more closely watched and one of the more hotter races locally, which under the old system probably would not have been the case. You have several other House races around the state of California where you have Republicans against Republicans and Democrats against Democrats. Now, the idea behind that reform 2 years ago was that this should give people who are more ideologically moderate a bit of a better chance of winning and being represented in the state legislature and Congress than the ideological extremists. Whether that will happen or not, well, we'll see.
Yeah, we will. And a couple of the local initiatives, basically, Measure O, which we've heard so little about, but could have a huge impact, and that Fresno County supervisors would be able basically to outsource certain departments or positions with a three majority vote instead of a four.
Yeah, right now you need a supermajority of the county board of supervisors to basically take a traditional county function and move it over to the private sector. And because of that, there's not been a whole lot of outsourcing going on in the county. And the county has some very serious budget issues, some very serious structural budget issues. Budget holes that are not going to go away in the near future. And one idea is that if we can outsource, then that might be a way to reduce costs. Now, there's also an argument to be made we should not do this, that there are a number of functions that are supposed to be public, like maybe the public defender's office for
right.
the county.
And that was a huge concern.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So we'll see how that goes. And especially, like I said, you didn't hear a lot about it. So
that's true.
That is one of those measures where people will really have to read it and pay attention and, vote whichever way they choose to vote.
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. Prop 30, Prop 32 have sort of, in the course of the presidential race to some extent, have sucked up a lot of the political oxygen. And so, the library Measure B hasn't gotten a lot of attention, Measure O, or the city Fresno Measure F. Even I had to go back and really try to read about Measure F.
So what is Measure F?
Oh, I think Measure F gives the Fresno City Council a little bit more budget authority and I think somewhat expanded role in
but
budgetary
right.
planning.
But you're right. We have not heard about those. So it really – you really have to – when you get your – your ballot in the mail, you have to read that and you have to pay attention to it. You just can't go to the polls and just check anything. And that's the way it's gotten, too, when you look not just here. I think I was reading something about, some of the ballots in Florida. I mean, we have how many? We have 11 propositions, I think, on the ballot. And then you have the local measures and then you have the presidential race. So you have to take your time and really study these issues.
And there's a certain exhaustion that goes along with that. And that tends to disadvantage ballot measures further down the ballot. The voter goes into the voting booth, makes decisions on candidates and then starts with the Prop 30 and wades through these propositions, some of which are really confusing and not well written. And they get exhausted after a while. And it's just like, forget it. I'm not going to vote on these. And that's not good.
Let's talk a little bit about the big race of today, and that is the presidential election. Mm-hmm. And that is probably one race that people will be glad to that it's now finally over and people just have to vote.
Been going on forever.
Yeah, but people just have to vote right now. But nationwide, I mean, they're saying this race is so tight, it's almost even at this point.
Yes. Yes. In terms of the popular vote, depending on which poll you look at, are they dead even? Has President Obama opened up a 1 or 2% margin as he may have? But it's still in the margin of error. So as far as from a statistical point of view, that election is tied. Of course, the popular vote is not how we choose presidents in the United States. It depends on the number of electoral votes and the electoral college each is able to rack up. Wouldn't that mean some states are vastly more important than others? And California is actually not considered overly important.
It's been amazing that I don't think except for this last week or two, I don't think I saw one campaign ad on TV.
Right.
And you're like, okay, we're over here.
Yeah, but now,
don't leave us out.
But if you've been living in Ohio, Virginia,
can you imagine what those people
Florida.
Have been through? No wonder they're doing early voting.
But, yes. Get it over with.
But when you look at this, when you look at how close this race is it also an indication of just how divided? I mean, if we are divided and this election is so close where you almost have, you know, the same amount of people. What does it say about whoever gets elected, how they're going to be able to govern? I mean, we've just gone through this, you know, the last 4 years.
Whoever wins probably won't really be able to govern a whole lot. We're, you know, it's hard to imagine a scenario right now where one party takes control of, you know, the entire government, both Congress and the White House. I just don't see that happening. Which means that we're going to be faced with the same kind of gridlock we've had over, you know, for the last 2 years. And so, I mean, I think there's going to be enough agreement at the end of the year in Congress and whoever gets the presidency to, you know, save us from this fiscal cliff everyone's been hearing and talking about, you know, the enormous cuts to the social safety net and defense programs and changes in the tax rates. That, I don't think that'll – that stuff's probably not going to happen. But after that, you know, keeping the country on track in terms of its economy and healing the damage done from years ago, it's just, you know.
I know. It's going to be difficult because it will take both parties to work together to continue this.
And so, Americans want that.
I mean, they definitely do. I mean, they do want it, but then they don't vote that way. So,
yeah, but Americans want Congress and the president all to work together, although the Americans are divided on what they want the Congress and the president to do, and that leads to the polarization.
And so it becomes very difficult. Let's look at the issues that we have developing. There's been a lot written about them in both the two battleground states, Ohio and Florida, and what we're seeing with the voting. In both cases, you've had in Ohio, the Secretary of State, and also in Florida, either shortening the early voting dates, not willing to budge on that, and leaving people standing in line for 9-10 hours to vote.
Yeah, that's been a big deal this election year in several states where changes have been made in the voting laws, sometimes attempts to restrict the number of people who can vote by requiring them to show certain forms of ID. And a lot of the recent controversies have been about early voting, who can vote early, how long before the election you're allowed to vote, and whether election offices should be open over the weekend. And it was a big controversy in Florida over that, and you know this is leading to, you know, lawsuits. And
I mean, that's what I mean. You can expect if this race does come down and is very, very close, even if it's not, you know, the lawyers have already lined up, and depending on what could happen, this race could not be decided.
It's possible.
So I'm sure there are a lot of people who are just hoping somebody gets a majority because they don't want to have to go through that.
Now, some of the battleground states like Ohio and Virginia, they're claiming that they're so on top of, you know, early voter registration and stuff that they can report final numbers this evening. We'll see if that's true. Whereas Florida...
Again,
that's the concern. You know, Florida may not be able to report numbers, and if it's really close, and if things hinge on the presidential election this year in Florida, as they did back in 2000, then we could have another major repeat of all that.
And one quick thing before I let you go, there's been much said about the big storm Sandy. Do you think it had an impact, or could it have an impact? Because I'm thinking, you know, the way I might think, and that if I'm in one of those affected areas and, you know, I don't have any place to go, my house is destroyed, you know, I'm not so much thinking about the election.
No, not so much. You're worried about getting your power back and, you know, finding something to eat and finding some gas to put in your car and things. But on the other hand, I hear that a lot of people are still taking voting very seriously out there. Now,
I think it says a lot about our country and the people that no matter what it is they're going through, they still value their right to vote and will vote. But like I said, when you take a look at what those folks are going through, it's very hard to imagine anything else kind of being on their mind except, you know, trying to get back to normal and the basic necessities.
Yeah, it's, well, we will see. I mean, there's Hurricane Sandy is being credited by some as giving Obama a bump up and, by looking presidential. Maybe that's true. All the coverage on Hurricane Sandy has meant that actually some of the final arguments made by Mitt Romney haven't gotten the exposure that they were hoping to get. The hurricane, one way or another, could make a bit of a difference. We'll find out.
We will definitely find out. And let's take a look at this, too. Even though we know what's happening with the votes in Iowa and Florida, there is a possibility that we could know fairly early.
Yeah.
Or not know, but we could know fairly early, you know, if there is a clear winner. Yeah. And and that might happen because when you have an election like we've had with this, with so much media attention, almost like it's a football game or something, sometimes, you know, the public just kind of proves us all wrong.
Yeah. Well, that can happen. I think we'll probably know who the president is sometime tonight. I think we probably will. I think what's going to be sitting around out there waiting for it to be figured out is, you know, decisions on Prop 30. Because that – I mean, more Californians are mailing in their ballots this year than are going to the polls. And that's going to take a lot of time to count. So close issues like Prop 30 could be, you know, undecided for a couple more weeks.
And that's one of the things, too, we've seen this year is really the increase in people voting before Election Day.
Yeah, over half of Californians are expected to vote by mail.
Right.
So that's, it makes a first.
a huge difference. And in California, we have that. And so it means a wait for us to know about some of the issues that are so important to Californians. But also nationally, you've had so many people do early voting and some of the other ways to vote. So it will be interesting. We will all be watching tonight and just kind of wait and see what happens. But, you know, one of the things I think to take a look at where Californians are, you know, we do have some new information out about the latest field poll. And the latest field poll shows that a record number of Californians, as you mentioned, have registered to vote. But the latest field poll estimates that there likely will be a million fewer votes today than in the presidential election of 2008. Now, the poll predicts 12.75 million Californians, or about 70% of registered voters, will cast ballots. And for the first time in a statewide election, the majority, 51%, will vote by mail.
Yeah, it's...
And... the director of the field poll, he says many people wait until Election Day to drop their ballots at polling places.
Those probably don't get counted for another couple weeks. So the outcome of very close statewide ballot propositions could be hanging in the balance, and that could include the governor's Prop 30. That's expected to be very close, and maybe even the death penalty repeal might be an extremely close one as well.
Now, voters are urged to drop ballots off at polling places or at their county elections office if they have not yet been mailed. But just as you said, the way we're voting this year could have an impact on us learning the outcome of Proposition 30. And, you know, we've heard so much about this not being the same as in 2008. But nothing is going to be the same as it was in 2008 because you have to look at historically what was happening there, and that's not the case this time around. So I think when I see that and people compare the two, I say there's really no comparison.
Yeah, this is what we call the enthusiasm gap.
reality setting in.
That's right. You know, 2008 was kind of something we hadn't seen in a long time. People were just, you know, so excited about participating.
Right, and everybody, it really didn't matter. Really, it really didn't matter the party.
Yeah.
People were just excited to see something that historical happen in this country.
Yeah, historical. And, you know, in 2008, everything was falling apart. You could feel that, you know, everything was falling apart. So when a candidate comes out and really is good at promoting the idea of change and pulling it all back together, people got really excited about that. So excited that they think they invested President Obama with these certain superpowers
that nobody could really do, right, to be honest with you. So. Yeah. Okay. Well, it is Election Day. Encourage everybody to go out and vote, and we'll be all up late tonight. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition.
Support for Valley Edition comes from Cahuilla Delta Medical Center and Kaiser Permanente.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition. Well, the aftermath of that huge storm, Sandy, is still impacting millions of people along the eastern seaboard. Red Cross volunteers from across the country are being pressed into action, and utility crews, dozens from Fresno and the Central Valley, are back there helping to restore power. Here to talk about the local response is Jennifer Perfect, Public Support Officer, Kern Chapter, American Red Cross. Thanks so much, Jennifer, for joining us.
How are you?
Hi. Let's talk a little bit about the local response when you look at Red Cross volunteers. Just how many are back there now?
Well, from the Central Valley, there are 10 volunteers that have been deployed and two more that are leaving this afternoon. So it's definitely a good group of volunteers who are on their way out there.
But it's not
already there.
But it's not just the volunteers. It's the work that the Red Cross does. I mean, what are they charged with? What will they be doing, those who are already there and those who are on their way? What, when you talk to people, what is their greatest need?
The greatest need right now is opening the shelters was what the volunteers were sent there originally for, and now they're maintaining those shelters and making sure that there's meals available at the shelters so that people have a safe place to go to. And then we have another group of volunteers who have been driving the emergency response vehicles out there, and these large vehicles are used to do mass feedings.
From your contact with volunteers who are there, you know, the people that they're trying to help, you know, from what I've seen and what I've read, there are some people, and you have shelters, and they're very concerned about this, that you have shelters, but you have so many residents who are staying in their homes without power.
Yes, and that's what the emergency response vehicles are for. They're driving around with mobile feeding, and there's also fixed feeding sites. So they can go to those shelters and they can get food. They don't have to stay there. It's a place for them so that they can get meals or cleanup kits or other hygiene items at those locations. So those shelters aren't just for people to stay at. They're also there for resources, which is amazing that the volunteers are there for.
Was there any difficulty? Because when you listen to some of the news reports, I think there were a couple of boroughs in New York where people had to wait a few days. Was it difficult getting into some of these places?
Definitely. With this huge of an event, there is a lot of difficulty getting around. We weren't able to even deploy some of our volunteers until a few days after because there was nowhere for them to fly into. So literally we couldn't even get our volunteers there, and there was local Red Cross chapters over there that were only able to recruit volunteers who could drive, and a lot of them have been affected by the disaster. So definitely lots of difficulties with transportation.
About how many, when you have a disaster like this, and you all have seen, you know, worse. We had Katrina and some of the others. When you have a disaster like this, what does it do to your resources and the manpower? Is it, are you sending everybody basically?
We have sent our emergency response vehicle and our volunteers. But we have other volunteers who are stepping up, but we definitely need to keep in mind that every disaster is someone's local disaster, and so we want to make sure that we have volunteers who are still here and available to respond to those single-family fires and events that we have going on, and plus that we're still getting our donations in as well as sending donations for Hurricane Sandy. We've seen a lot of people sending in those 50-50 donations, half for Hurricane Sandy and half for the local chapter, so that their donation that normally would go to the local chapter isn't completely gone. So people have been very generous.
And isn't that something people need to be aware of when you do donate to the Red Cross. Should you say where you want it to go, or does it just all go into one pot?
Well, if they don't put where it goes into the fund, which is what we use for response. There's a general fund that we use for all of our mission services. But if people have a certain tie to, let's say, Superstore Sandy, they can write that on there. Or if they have a certain tie to the local chapter, they can write, for instance, I'm out of the Kern office. So they can put in American Red Cross Kern office on their donation. And that is something that the Red Cross will completely honor. So if you have a certain area that you want to help, send it in. But if you send it to the Red Cross, it goes into the fund that helps all of our mission services, whatever the greatest need is at that moment.
So, for instance, we've seen a lot of efforts on behalf of Hurricane Sandy. Like, I know ABC 30 had a day of giving. You also had a situation in New York where you had a group of entertainers come together and perform. Now, when you see something like that, now that money, is it just goes to the Red Cross, or is that something that has been designated as a relief effort for Hurricane Sandy?
It depends on where the donation came in through and what people designated. For instance, the telethon, when people were calling in, it was for Hurricane Sandy. Now, for the day of giving, people could have went online and they could have gave to their local chapter, they could have gave to, it's wherever they designated. And if you go to redcross.org, that money you can designate right there on the site. It says your local chapter, where the greatest need is, the disaster relief, you can choose, which is just an amazing thing that the Red Cross will always make available.
Jennifer, at this point, what is the biggest need?
The biggest need is donations. We can't ship items there. It costs too much money. It's always better to buy the items from the local affected area. So if people can go on redcross.org and make a donation, or they can text Red Cross to 90999, and that makes a $10 donation to Hurricane Sandy. $10 really isn't a big deal in most people's lives, but it does make a big difference in this relief operation.
But also, people can still help and contribute and donate, but have you gotten a sense of what is the biggest need there on the ground in the disaster area itself, the disaster zone?
Well, the biggest need right now is donations so that we can continue to provide the services that are needing, those mobile feedings, the shelters, the healthcare contacts. We have mental health workers there. We have nurses there helping if there is a need for a nurse. So for us to be able to continue to have those volunteers and those resources out there, we need to have the backing of the American people.
When you look at, what they're saying in New York is the number of people who have displaced and don't have a home. So when you think about how long it's going to take to rebuild, because you have people whose homes were just destroyed, and you think about how long it's going to take to rebuild, does that mean that ongoing support from Red Cross to these folks will be needed and could go on for a long, long time?
Yeah, the volunteers, they've been deployed for a minimum of 2 weeks, so they're already committed to be there to make sure that people can get back onto their feet. Our goal is to meet their immediate needs and try to get them into long-term assistance. We don't personally do the long-term assistance, so that's insurance claims, so on and so forth. Our goal is to make sure that they have food, clothing, and shelter right now, and that's what our volunteers are focused on. Our mental health volunteers are making sure that they're there to listen, to help them get back on their feet and give guidance, because it's a very overwhelming experience.
I'm sure it is. I just could not imagine for so many of those people have to be in that situation. Jennifer Perfect, Public Support Officer, Kern Chapter, American Red Cross, thanks so much for joining us. And for our listeners out there, you heard there are still ways for you to donate and to help by donating to the American Red Cross, and they will make sure the money you donate gets to where you want it to go. Thanks so much, Jennifer, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you're listening to Valley Edition.
The 2012 election will be remembered for a number of things, from the contentious presidential debates to the tragedy of Hurricane Sandy. The issue of women's rights stood out as well, as a number of candidates in statewide races made controversial comments about rape. In this edition of our commentary series, The Moral Is, Andrew Fiala says in the national dialogue that has followed, one thing has been largely absent: listening.
As a man, I'm a bit embarrassed about recent male pontificating about the issue of rape and abortion. Todd Akin, a candidate for Senate in Missouri, said, "If it's a legitimate rape, the female body has ways to try to shut that whole thing down." In a debate in Indiana, another Senate candidate, Richard Murdoch, said that if a woman gets pregnant during rape, that it was something that God intended. And Joe Walsh in Illinois said that even in case of rape, he's still pro-life. He explained with regard to the fetus produced by rape, there is still a life there. This point of view fits well with what the Catholic Church calls a consistent ethic of life. From this point of view, life begins at conception, and from there on out, life is sacred. This leads the Catholic Church to also condemn a variety of other things that harm or take life: suicide, war, euthanasia, and the death penalty. Even poverty can be condemned as anti-life. There's much to be admired in the consistency of this idea. But rape poses a problem for this pristine consistency. The real world is messy, and exceptions might be made in the face of horrible tragedy. We tend to forget that compassion and care are as important as being consistent. There's something typically masculine about the emphasis on consistency in the face of tragic ethical choices. Indeed, this whole issue is tinged with an embarrassing amount of good old-fashioned male chauvinism. Men tend to forget that rape is not just one thing. When young girls are bullied into sex by older men, that's rape. When drunken women are taken advantage of, that's rape. When women are oppressed by their husbands and coerced into sex, that's rape. Perhaps we men should think of the issue from the standpoint of our mothers, wives, sisters, and daughters. What would you do if your daughter were date raped and became pregnant as a result? As her body changed through 9 months of pregnancy, what would you think? More importantly, how would you feel? Obviously, the most important question is how the woman would feel and what she would think. It's her body, after all. But the men involved might benefit from a bit more reflection on their own feelings and a bit more sensitivity to the women whose bodies have been abused by men. I worry that when men try to tell women what they should do in case of rape, we reassert a male-dominant power structure. The problem is that rape is an act of male dominance to begin with. A step in the right direction would include listening to women and asking them what they think and how they feel. Some women might agree with the idea that abortion is not permissible, even in the case of rape. But we men will never know this until we stop pontificating and learn to listen to what women have to say about the issue. For The Moral Is, this is Andrew Fiala.
The commentary series The Moral Is was produced by Valley Public Radio in association with the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. The opinions expressed are those of the writer and not necessarily Valley Public Radio. Send us your comments with an email. The address is talk@kvpr.org.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Valley Edition. Welcome back. I'm Juanita Stevenson, and you are listening to Valley Edition. On November 11th, the world-famous Dance Theater of Harlem will return for a performance at the William Saroyan Theater. Their first appearance since 2002. Joining us to talk about the rebirth of the dance company and its upcoming performance is our artistic director, Virginia Johnson. Ms. Johnson, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really thrilled that we're coming back to Fresno.
Oh, we're so happy to have you. Now, you are a founding member of the dance company, plus a prima ballerina who danced with the company. What was that like for you in the beginning to be part of something?
to be part of something really amazing. You know, it was 1969. I had studied ballet dancing all of my life. I was dreaming of being a ballerina. And at that point, the director of my school came to me and he said, well, you know, I don't think you should think about being a ballet dancer. I think you should try modern dance because there aren't any black ballerinas. And that was actually the first time anybody had said that to me, which I suppose is a good thing because I did prepare myself, but it was a rude awakening to a situation that I wasn't aware of. So I came to New York in that fall, and I found out that Arthur Mitchell was teaching classes in Harlem, and he was starting a ballet company. And I was really very excited because this was my dream come true. Arthur Mitchell was creating this company for people like me who had been told, no, you can't do it. And he really wanted to prove to the world that given opportunity and access to training and the chance to develop into a fine artist, that you can do anything regardless of your color of your skin, where you come from, what your accent is. Given the chance to develop, you can become anything you want.
What was it like then being able to dance with that company at that time? I'm sure for all the young people who were given the opportunity to dance, this must have been huge for them.
It was a wonderful time. It was a very exciting thing to have an audience full of people thinking that they were going to see something like jazz or modern dance and see that we were on point in ballet in point shoes that were flesh-colored to our different shades of brown, to see this ballet company and change people's minds. You know, it was the 1960s. People were saying, well, should you be doing ballet? Why is it important for African Americans to do ballet? Shouldn't you be doing African dance? But, you know, that wasn't our point. Our point is if you've got the chance to do something and it's in your heart to do it, then you can define what that art form looks like. It was a crusade we were on, and so each of us felt that sense of mission of changing people's minds about what they expected from the art form.
Now, economic factors really forced the company to disband in 2004. That must have been very difficult for you all. And we definitely missed you here.
It was a terrible time in the organization. And, you know, the dancers who were performing with that company, I had retired by then. You know, that was a long time after 1969. But the dancers who were in that company, many of them, it was the end of their career, and that was a real heartbreak. But it was hard for the organization also because we didn't have a touring company as a visible face of what Dance Theater Harlem is about. So it's been, the past 8 years have been about restoring the power of this professional company to the organization.
What did it take to bring the group back together?
You know, it took a very cold, hard look at the changed economic climate that we're all living in now, a commitment from many funders who believed in what our mission was, and it took a very watertight plan. The executive director, Levine Naidu, and I sat down and we created a 5-year plan. The goal of which was to stabilize the organization to the point where we would be able to sustain a company. So that was the first 2 years was stabilizing the company. In the third year, which is where we are now, is bringing the company back. And then we have 2 more years of this 5-year plan to keep carrying the company forward, touring more, getting more dance company members, building it back up, but in a gradual, sustainable way.
Now, I read a recent article. It was talking about the 18 dancers that you have brought together to take the dance company into the future. Tell me a little bit about them.
It's a great group of young artists who are very excited to be once again building this institution, building this brand of Dance Theater of Harlem. 10 of them came from our Dance Theater of Harlem Ensemble, which was a second company that was developed about 4 years ago to give them the chance to perform in front of audiences and build up their strength, their technical and performing strength, their artistry. So they kind of form the nucleus of this company. But we also have dancers. We had an audition tour earlier this year. We went to San Francisco and Chicago and Miami and here in New York. We auditioned dancers to find the very, very best dancers of color to make up this new Dance Theater of Harlem.
Now, when you perform here on November 11th at the Sororian Theater, what will we see?
It's a typical Dance Theater Harlem program, if people remember Dance Theater Harlem. It is a very eclectic evening that will show you many different styles of dancing. We have a work that was created by our resident choreographer, Robert Garland, specifically for this group of 18 dancers. And it is to the music by Francis Poulenc. It's his Gloria. It's a glorious work. It's a full company work. There are two small works, two pas de deux. One is a contemporary love story, When Love, choreographed by Helen Pickett to the music of Philip Glass. We have the Black Swan pas de deux, because, you know, Dance Theatre of Harlem is a classical ballet company, and we always have presented a classical work as part of our repertoire. Black Swan is brand new to Dance Theatre of Harlem, and I'm really excited to present it in our opening season.
Wow, that sounds great.
We also have The Lark Ascending, which is a work that was created by Alvin Ailey for his company in 1972. Dance Theatre of Harlem is the only company besides the Ailey Company that performs this. And the very unique thing about Lark Ascending at Dance Theatre of Harlem is that it is done on point. It is an exquisite work, and I'm loving having it in rehearsal because I get to hear that music all day long.
Well, Virginia
we'll
Johnson.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
It's a very full program. The final part of the program is a new work by Donald Byrd, Contested Space. It's a very 21st century ballet. It uses the point work and the vocabulary, but it's telling a 21st century relationship story. So it's a very jam-packed evening.
Well, we are looking forward to having you back. Virginia Johnson, Artistic Director, Dance Theatre of Harlem. Thanks so much for sharing some time with us this morning.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm very much looking forward to getting there.
Okay. Well, that is all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kbpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kbpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, and executive producer Joe Moore, I'm Juanita Stevenson, and this is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation,